Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another of our, well, sporadic episodes, honestly, that we call A Rugby Life, in which I have a lovely chat with somebody about, well, about their life in rugby, really. It's quite simple, but and maybe a few other things as we go through. I'm really pleased to say that this episode, I'm chatting with journalist, presenter and author of this recently released book, The Red Roses, Behind the Scenes with the England Rugby Women's Rugby Team. It's Jess Hayden. Hiya, Jess.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Not at all. So the book, we're going to talk about the book and among other things, but you've wasted very little time in the opening line of the first chapter of the book after you've got the intro out of the way. You basically open with two very pithy sentences. Women's rugby is a feminist issue, full stop. It always has been, full stop. How much of that definite kind of view came through in the process of writing the book or versus what you already knew kind of going in?
It's interesting because I thought I knew the history of women's rugby, but when writing the book and researching, talking to different historians and people who'd already looked into it, I realised that the waves of women's rugby participation align almost perfectly with the three waves of feminism that I studied as a politics student years ago. I just thought that's so interesting that you see that it follows the same trends. Yeah. And I think it kind of sparked something in me. I've always been a very proud feminist, and I actually say in my acknowledgements that my phone always autocorrects women's rugby to women's rights, which tells a lot about how much I enjoy kind of feminism and women behaving badly. And I think it's quite a dramatic way to start it. And when you said it just then, I was half cringing because it's such a punch in the face as you opened the book. But I feel like it was needed to kind of set the tone for the book, that this is about women achieving incredible things and not to kind of hide away from that.
Picking up that point about is a punchy way to start, but that first chapter does cover a lot of that history you just described, doesn't it? So in a way, I think I can see how, having read all that, you won't want to say, do you know what, I'm just going to get this out of the way. But I suppose in terms of the tone of the book, there's a lot of what I think is really nice, actually. One, your voice comes through brilliantly, but two, there's a lot of editorializing in the book, I suppose, is the way I read it, in that, well, no, what I mean is you don't mind saying, this is what I think about this.
Yeah.
And this is why I think that was wrong, or why I think that was great, or why I think that was, and that's a, you know, it's a feminist issue, bang, I'm just saying it straight away. How much of that is the way you write anyway, and what you thought you wanted the book to be? Or did you find that as you were researching, you were just like, you know what, I'm finding so much stuff, I have to just go this way with it?
It's a good question. I think I was very aware that I wanted to take myself out of it. I didn't want to be narrating the story because no one really needs that. But I wanted to, I feel like there were times when it was relevant to say why I think what I think and kind of put a journalistic kind of guys in it, because I was very big on this book needs to have journalistic integrity. I'm not a cheerleader. I'm not a PR person. This book needs to be a truthful account of women's rugby and the Red Roses. So I guess I always knew that I would have my voice in it at some point to kind of carry through the story. But I definitely didn't go into it kind of knowing how much of that I would do. So there's a few points in the book where I say, you know, I talk about the an attack on a journalist who did some player ratings and stuff like that. And I kind of do put in my kind of opinion quite a bit in the end. I hope not too much, but I did want to kind of make clear, you know, I worked on the documentary behind the scenes with the England women's rugby team called Wear the Rose. And I have had unparalleled access to the squad for a long time. So I just really thought that actually sometimes my opinion was really valid and worth putting in. But as a journalist, you know, you're always trying to kind of keep yourself out of the story. So it was a bit of a battle with myself to force myself to put myself in it at times.
I mean, the respect you have for the squad really comes through, and you've quite clearly got a relationship with a number of them.
Yeah.
But, you know, how difficult was that then, having to sort of unpick what are quite clearly some friendships? It feels it comes off the page, and that's not in a bad way at all, but clearly it's really nice. But how difficult was that, with the points at which you struggled with the separation?
It's a great question again. And I tried to be as unbiased as I could be. And I wouldn't say I'm friends with any of the players, because we have kind of like a professional relationship. But there are players that I'm closer to and that I've worked with a lot over the years, and that if I called and asked a question, they'd pick up and happily give me 5 minutes of their time. Yeah. So that helped. But I think a challenge was actually finding out about people and hearing different opinions about people, and especially people like Simon Middleton. I don't think he comes across brilliantly in the book, whereas I have to be honest, he's always been incredible to me. He's very kind to journalists. I always say, you know, one of the kindest things he ever did to me for me was just remember my name all the time and come over and, you know, shout across the Stonex Stadium to say hiya, because he recognised me across the room and stuff like that of the stadium. But actually, you have to listen to other people's opinions on these things. So I hope it's unbiased. And quite a few players have said, who've read it, have said, oh, it's you completely, like, you got me, you've explained me. So people who've read it, who are players, have said that the description of Tatiana Hurd is spot on. Poppy Cleal comes across exactly how I know Poppy to be, quite, can be quite confrontational, abrasive at times, but really a warm person and very loving. And I think Marley's another one. You know, Marley and I aren't close. We've worked together a lot. We've never, I've never like written a column for her or anything like that, yeah. But I've spoken to her a lot. And I go into quite a lot of detail about what she's actually like and how she is to talk to, because I feel like it's relevant. People want to know what these people are like. And it's always the thing of the fear that your favourite sports person is actually a bit of a dickhead behind closed doors. And that's kind of, I wanted to be able to give people a kind of rounded view of what these women are actually like. And yeah, I think that's it.
No, it was good. I mean, I was quite moved by reading the stuff that Marley Packer said about her dad, actually, and how she's trying to grapple with that, knowing she's a parent now and everything. It was really powerful stuff. Well done for extracting it. And I suppose for her, she strikes me as quite an honest character anyway. So maybe that was helpful. But yeah, really, I said little nuggets like that that you wouldn't really find anywhere else. So really.
Yeah, really, I think good. It's the trust. That's such an important thing. They know me. I'm not someone that's come in to try and make some money off writing a book and don't really care about women's rugby. They know me. They know that I've been around for a long time. I know them well. I know some of their parents because I see them at games and we have chats, or they talk to me on Twitter. And when we did the documentary, I spent a lot of time with them as well. So I think without that trust and level of exposure to me, they would, the doors wouldn't have opened as quickly. So there's that, I guess. When you said like relationships and friendships, I think they do quite naturally form because we're all women in a very, you know, in rugby, they might be much better players than I am, which is an understatement, but we have that kind of relationship anyway. We can chat about what we watched on the weekend and stuff like that. And also I'm a young woman and I'm a similar age to most of the squad. And I think that helped because when they're talking about Married at First Sight, I can join in. And when they're talking about EastEnders, I can chip in and give my like 2 pence on what I think's happening. And yes, that did help, I think. And I think they just opened up to me because they recognised that I do genuinely care about the squad.
I'll come back to the book in a minute, but this is a bit of a rugby life thing as well. So I always ask this question of everybody who comes on, you know, how and where did your rugby life begin?
So it started when I joined Swansea University and I was 19 when I went to a freshers' fair in my second year, and I saw this girl with a can of cider in her hand and she was doing a straight arm pint, which is where you try and drink a pint without bending your elbow. And so she's pouring it all over her face. And I just thought, whatever society she's in, I want to join. And I could have ended up being in the Christian society for all I knew. But
I was going to say philosophy, yeah.
But thankfully, she was a rugby player, Clara, and she's still one of my closest friends. And I just really wanted to join that. And so I joined the rugby team there. And I'll just tell you quickly, because my first ever training session, I turned up in a Springboks jersey because I'd been bought it for my 17th birthday because I was in South Africa for it. And I knew nothing about rugby, but the coach, Cookie, thought that, oh, she's wearing a Springboks jersey, she must know about rugby. So he asked me if I wanted to play in the old girls versus new girls fixture, which is the freshers versus the alumnus of Swansea University. But if you look at the alumna of Swansea Uni, you've got like basically a Wales starting 15. Like it's so many of the Wales girls went to Swansea. And so the first time I
played... Did you know who they were then?
No, but I knew who... I didn't know who most of them were. So I've seen photos since and then like kind of doing a who's who of previous Wales women players. But I knew who Siobhan Lillycrap was because I'd been introduced to her and she was terrifying to me at the time. She was the Wales captain. Or she hadn't been given the Wales captaincy yet, but she was a Wales player and, you know, very good. And... the first time I had the ball, I was playing, I don't even know what position I was playing, so I knew nothing about rugby, like nothing. I didn't watch rugby growing up. I remember the 2003 World Cup final, but there was no rugby club near me. I didn't grow up, I went to a state school that didn't have a rugby team or anything like that. So I had no introduction to rugby until I was 19. And I had the ball and Shuan's running towards me. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to be tackled. I didn't know what I was meant to do when I was tackled. So I just passed her the ball. there you go.
So I don't know what version of fight or flight that is. Was it something in between?
I was
mad though, isn't it? Because I mean, I was a terrible rugby player. You know, I enjoyed it. I knew a bit more than you did at 19, but I wasn't very good. And it's the idea of that's the equivalent of me turning up in my uselessness. And then the first person who runs at me would be Taulupe Faletau or something.
Yeah.
They'd be like, oh my God. I mean, that'd just be genuinely, you know, I have some empathy with you because that would just be absolutely terrifying. Yeah.
I think back now and the players in my team were people like Natalia John and Courtney Keat who are playing in this Six Nations. And I just feel grateful that I have an old girls fixture on in June the 1st and I'm one of the old girls now, depressingly so. And there's no way I'll play because I've got a whole host of Wales internationals that are ahead of me for a starting shirt. So I'm just going to be on the sideline, probably drunk and not getting involved.
I'm going home and I'm not tackling anybody. That's a good thing about those social games, isn't it? To pick up that point you just made, though, that you knew nothing about it, I played rugby and loved it from being young, and I'm always quite fascinated by people who have a desire to start doing it at 18, 19, because I always feel almost like if you haven't been brought up in the stupidity of it, because running into people hard and getting flattened and getting hurt is not an obvious thing to do unless I've always thought you're conditioned in it. So what made you 18, 19 think, oh, that looks like a bit of me, you know?
honestly, I can only say that the girls who were playing it seemed really fun and I wanted to have a go. But then I did fall in love with it very fast and I loved playing rugby. I still miss it and I only stopped quite recently because I like broke my thumb and I just was turning up to work with black eyes all the time and I really didn't like that. So I don't know what kind of compelled me to start. The first game I went to was Saracens Harlequins Men. Because my dad's best friend was a Saracen season ticket holder, so he took me to a game when I was kind of considering what like playing, but not really. I had honestly no one in my family plays rugby. No, you know, none of them the men either. My dad kind of liked it, but was more of like a Six Nations fan. I've kind of now we go to lots of games together, and he loves the women's game, but I have no rugby club anywhere near me. I live in Essex and the closest club to me is Saracens, but even that's a fair journey away. And the local clubs, there was no girls rugby. I knew no one that played rugby when I was growing up. Yeah, nothing at all. So I liked women's football. I played football and kind of my introduction to sport. I've always been a huge football fan. I was a Southend United season ticket holder for my whole childhood. And still go and support
bad
them.
Bad times right now.
We're doing good now. The bad times are over. We went bankrupt, but now we've got some owners that are going to save us.
You're in the Southern Conference now, aren't you?
Yeah, no, we're doing really badly. But
I only know that because I'm an Oldham fan, and it's not been great for us either, but I thought, at least we're not Southend.
but it's
been bad, though, hasn't it? Because, I mean, that brilliant, for that level of football, that stadium and everything, and just...
Yeah. I remember when we were in the championship. I was going every week.
Stan Collymore days.
Well, he's back. You know, he's our director of football now.
Is he really? Oh, I didn't know that. All right.
he's a funny one.
Yeah. Sorry. Carry on. You're into football.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. So I always love my football and I still absolutely love my football. And I think I watch more football than rugby still, I think, because I watch football every night. I watch whatever's on.
Because you've written about football as well, haven't you? You've done football journalism as well.
Yeah, a little bit, but not as much as I should do, really. But I love rugby more now. Rugby's my sport, women's rugby in particular, I love. But I'm always watching football. So it's kind of a weird one. But I'm not one of those people that just likes rugby, so writes about it. I adore rugby. I'm watching it all the time. I go and watch grassroots games. I go and watch the PWR as much as I can. And like Premiership Rugby as well. And Six Nations World Cup. But like I am definitely a rugby fan and journalist. I absolutely adore it. And you do have, like, as you know, you do sometimes have people who write about rugby for a living who don't actually enjoy it, don't actually like it that much.
Or even watch it. It's an interesting one, though, isn't it? Well, I was going to ask you, did you always want to be a rugby journalist? Well, clearly not, because you didn't really pick it up. You may have, since you discovered rugby. Did you always want to be a journalist? Was that a thing? Did you want to be a writer? Is that what you always wanted to do?
I think I wanted to be a politician for a long time. I wanted to be an MP.
I won't ask which type. of what stripe, but carry on.
Yeah. I wanted to be a MP. And so I studied politics at uni. I'm very passionately and proudly a Labour Party member, and I wanted to...
That's right, you can stay there. We can talk about politics as much as you want then. That's good.
Yeah,
that's
great. As long as I didn't say I was a Tory, right? I wanted to be an MP, and then as I was studying politics, that's when I started playing rugby, and I met Shuan, as I just said, and... The first time I wanted to be a rugby journalist at all was when she was telling me about her life and how she was playing rugby three times a week and training and coaching and having a full-time job alongside playing for Swansea, Ospreys and Wales at the time. So she would have like multiple games a week. And I just thought I'd done quite a lot of journalism as a student, and I did a documentary when I was like 14 about the activism I was doing. In fact, I was 16. About activism I was doing, about sexism in the media, especially kind of Page Three. I was doing quite a lot of stuff about that. And so I really knew that I really care about women's rights and stuff like that. And then I thought, oh, I might write about Xuan's life, because I was reading The Times and John Westerby had written this piece about why they should move the Women's Six Nations fixtures to the Wednesday away from the Saturday when it was in the same window as the men. And I thought, like, well, does he realise they all have full-time jobs, most of them, the vast majority at that point, and they play for other clubs as well? So I asked The Times if I could come and do work experience with the kind of motivation to write that piece, and they let me do it. And I wrote that piece.
That was in 2019, that the piece.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Were you still at uni then?
Was that in 2019? No, it must have been before that.
Or was it? Sorry.
Yeah, maybe. No, you're right, because 2019 was when... Oh, actually, let me think. No, so I'd graduated from my undergrad. I'd graduated completely. So when did I do work experience? That must have been like 2018, 2017. I can't think now when I did that.
Oh, it doesn't matter. Flummoxed you now. Carry on. It was a good story until I ruined it. Yeah, go on.
I can't remember the years. So I was definitely at uni when I wrote it, and it was about Xuan and all that. And so I got through. I spoke to a player from every union in England, Ireland, Wales, and Scotland, and it did quite well. And The Times said, "Could you stay on for another week?" So I did. And in that second week, I think they were expecting like another big piece of journalism, because that story won Story of the Week, which at the time The Times ran. They don't even do it anymore, but when I was on work experience, and it was the first time that someone on work experience had won that, and I got a bottle of wine. I was very pleased. And then the next week, the only piece I wrote was about the goat that leads the Welsh team out for the national anthem, Llywelyn Sheinclin III. So that's kind of how it started. I knew I wanted to be a rugby journalist then, and then I got some really good stories early on. A lot about concussion, because I really cared about that, because I'd had a very bad concussion, which led to a seizure when I played rugby. And so I cared a lot about it. So I wanted to write a lot about that and about how it affects women differently. And I kind of lucked out that one of the most prominent researchers into concussion in women's rugby was at Swansea University. So it was quite easy, because I could find their email address on our internal systems and got some pieces there. And it kind of grew from there. I started writing, then World Rugby reached out and said they liked the piece I'd written, would I write a bit for them? Then I did British and Irish Lions next, an interview with Bobby, the S&C coach, who was at Wales as well. And I did a piece of him, and it just kind of went from there. I got my rugby past column, and I was building up kind of a freelance rugby journalism sideline almost, because I had a full-time job. And then The Times had a job opening for sports sub-editor. And as kind of part of what it was sent to me as like, oh, why don't you consider this? You'd be able to write about women's rugby. And I thought, that sounds perfect. So got to write about women's rugby for them and do their podcast. I got to like have my own women's rugby series with that as well. And I've done presenting.
TV presenting, you know, just...
Yeah,
just did all these things.
It's quite naturally grown, I think, because I was very focused on the women's game always. Yeah. I've never really been I always say I'm more of a women's rugby journalist than a rugby journalist, because I follow the men's game. I watch it. I love it. I write about it. But I'm not as well connected and everything as I am in the women's game.
I love rugby, right? Obviously, it's why I do these things. But... sometimes covering it every week watching it's fine. Sometimes having to think about covering it in a way that's consumable to others, even if it's only barely consumable to others, can sometimes grind me down a bit, to be honest. But I've been doing it a while now, but it's not that I don't like it, but sometimes you are a bit like, oh, I think there's something to say about this now, and you know, in a way that's going to be interesting or whatever. Do you ever have that? Do you have that kind of like, you know, obviously your love of the game oozes out of the book and everything you've just said while we've been talking, but do you ever kind of experience, or how much do you ever experience and have to combat that kind of rugby fatigue or creativity fatigue, or has it not hit you yet?
I definitely have that, especially when I'm covering the Red Roses, like doing a live match report, whatever I'm doing, and you have to describe 10 tries that are all the same. How do I do this? And like, you're writing a report and you're like, right. And as you're typing one try, they're scoring another one. And then you're like, oh God, what happened there? What was the build up to that? And then you're writing that. So that's kind of how it's hit me a lot, is just women's rugby, especially the Red Roses. It can be quite repetitive, especially when the Red Roses were on like a 30 match winning streak. I think that's why the media, the media in big letters ended up being a bit more critical of the Red Roses than perhaps they deserved. Because they were held to such high standards. And we just had nothing left to say. We'd all said how brilliant they are and how amazing it is. So we needed to find something that they weren't good at. And the thing everyone landed on was that they were too reliant on their maul. And that became like the headlines for weeks in the Women's Six Nations, in the Women's Rugby World Cup in 2022. That's kind of where I've had a little bit of fatigue was with covering them. But then with the World Cup final, that definitely, it didn't lift my spirits at all, but it definitely gave me a bit more of a, right, well, there's interest now. There's something else could happen.
So going back to that then, because I'm interested to, obviously the book's out now. How long a process is something like this? I mean, were you expecting to write a book, or was the book commissioned because it was going to be the journey to winning a World Cup sort of thing, and then that didn't happen, or was that not what it was? Or
No, you're spot on. So the book, my literary agent Mel reached out to me in August 2022 and said, would love it if you'd write a book about the England women's rugby team and how they're going to win the World Cup. There's a publishers are interested. There's a book deal if you want it. We spoke about it. And I was like, yeah, I spoke to the publisher, explained how it was pretty nailed on that England were going to win the World Cup. New Zealand had such an awful lead up time. France looked quite good, but they were England's kind of most familiar rivals. It's going to be quite easy. It's almost a foregone conclusion that they're going to win. And I even went as far as writing not in the terms of writing a report about a tournament that hasn't happened yet, but I did write a little bit about, what it would mean if they won the World Cup, as if they'd already won it. And I was, I was all prepared that they were going to win the World Cup, and then I'd start writing my book about how they did it. So they kind of said, don't write it until it's happened, but, the book deal's there if they win it. If they don't win it, then there's no book. So when they lost the World Cup final, that final line out, obviously went down and New Zealand won in incredible style. I was hosting an event at the Cabbage Patch pub in Twickenham.
Oh, I remember that.
I had Giselle Mather and Hugo Monnier on my panel, and my dad was in the crowd, and he came up to me at the end and he was like, what game? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, but you're not writing a book anymore. And I was like, I was honestly like almost in tears. I was in tears. And I was like,
well, cheers, Dad. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm on stage now and talk about it. So it had gone. And then I was very lucky that my publisher, Berlin, said, I feel like there's still a book here, which to me, I was arguing that it was more interesting that they didn't win than if they had won.
That was my next question.
Yeah.
How hard is it to think, is it a better book because they didn't? Is it a better book to write, or is it a more interesting book?
I think it's more interesting because there's all that, the feeling, the jeopardy, all the real like mixed emotions, especially from the players who weren't selected for the World Cup. I think that sort of comes through. Sarah Beckett said to me that she didn't think she'd even be able to watch any of the games in the World Cup because she was so sad about not being selected. So I think it was more interesting because they lost it, because there's also like this path to rebuilding now. If they won it, I genuinely think it'd be hard to keep people as engaged for this Women's Six Nations or the last Women's Six Nations, because what's on the line, everyone just expects them to walk it now and walk the next World Cup. And obviously the next World Cup is in England's home in 2025. And there's jeopardy now. People know that they could well lose. And yeah, they might be the best team in the world and they might have a great winning streak. But John Mitchell always says, we need to turn winners into champions. That's the difference. They can win, but they can't win when it really counts. So I think it's more interesting. And I think that the publisher that didn't want it kind of missed out on actually a more interesting storyline. This is the first professional women's rugby team. They've been professional for the longest period of time. Everything, all that professionalism, all that money the RFU invested was based on this team winning the 2021 Rugby World Cup, and they didn't. And that that's more interesting to me. I care more about that than if they'd won it, because like, right, okay, well, what's next? You were professional, you were the most professional team, you won the World Cup, where's the story? So I do think it was more interesting.
John Mitchell, they love appointing a divisive bloke to coach this team, don't they? The RFU. I'll say that. You don't have to comment if you don't want.
No, I will say I was so sceptical when they announced him. I'd had an idea it was him because I'd heard who'd been in for interviews, and the players who were kind of involved in the selection decision had kind of suggested that he was one of the people. And I was very surprised by his selection, but I've spoken to him quite a few times now. And it's very early days, but I have to say, I'm so impressed not only by him, but by how the players view him and what he's trying to do, which he hasn't been able to demonstrate yet in this Women's Six Nations, because when you go down to 14 players 10 minutes into a game, it's hard to do that. But I'm going to have to say, as a person, so far, found him quite good and honest and open, which I really admire and pleased about, but also just, yeah, it means a lot to me when the players say how they feel, because they're very honest. They do not hold back with how they feel about anyone, and yeah, so far so good. But I'm definitely not saying, oh, I think he's the best thing ever, because I don't know him well enough yet, and yeah, we haven't seen what he's achieved yet. But I've definitely been pleasantly surprised by him.
To go back to the book then, the you cover in the opening bits of the book the history of the women's football codes, because you touch a bit on association football as well,
yeah, and
the history since we love rugby history around here. We did the rugby history episodes. We haven't done women's rugby, actually, so probably a good point to draw that out, actually. But given how shittily women's football codes have been treated, which, yeah, you very, very ably outline in the book, and it's really worth reading, how easy was it to research stuff like that? Is it, you know, from an archives point of view and everything, is it tricky?
It is. And I was really lucky that some people had kind of gone before me. So John Birch and Ali Donnelly at Scrum Queens had done a lot of research into it, but also Dr. Lydia First, who's a women's rugby researcher, who, if you do that episode, you've got to chat to her, because she's just kind of an encyclopedia.
Tony Collins put me in touch with her, and then it never quite materialised. I need to pull my finger out my backside and do it, yeah.
She's brilliant. She has so many stories that haven't even kind of been spoken about properly. And so actually with that chapter, it was really important to me that it was factually accurate, because, you know, a historian could write that chapter better than a journalist could, I thought. So I actually said to Lydia, I'm going to send you everything I have. I'm going to send you the chapter. Can you read through it? And, you know, with a fine tooth comb, go through anything that's quite a little bit wrong or anything like that. So it is, you know, it's doctor approved, that chapter, accurately it represents the history. But women's football history is written about far more, and it has a very similar trajectory to women's rugby, although interestingly there was more opposition to women's football than women's rugby because of how much more popular it was, even though the criticisms were, this is an unsafe game for females, and yet rugby didn't have that kind of in such a big way. It didn't have it on the same scale, but I think it's just because not as many women played it. But I do love that they have similar backgrounds. Mm. And I did touch a little bit on how both sports have kind of always been a very safe space for the LGBTQ plus community. And that's, I feel like that's quite interesting. They both have very similar roots.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's an interesting chapter. I think you do. I mean, historians are always useful, but they do a good job of summarising it all from a journalistic side. It's very readable and very interesting, I thought. To pick up on that, the kind of women's experience of the sport, there's a point in the book where you say, when you talk about what it is to be a woman playing rugby in a way, and you say, what the quote is, and it's part of a bigger few paragraphs, is, playing rugby means putting yourself in male-dominated spaces and thriving as a woman, yeah, basically. And I suppose it's I'm a bloke, right? So obviously I haven't thought as deeply about this as other people, and we have to kind of be told about these things and pause and think. I've often, you talk about having to go into a room full of blazers at clubs and stuff, yeah. which I would have obviously said, yeah, I understand that. One thing you do make a point about, I've never really thought about before, is this is that actually right from being a girl, you have to play in a male space.
Yeah.
Historically. Like if you're 8 years old, you have to play with mostly boys. Well, I mean, you didn't do that because you picked up, but I mean, do players ever talk about that and what that's like? Or,
well, I did it with football, so I have some of an idea of it, but not as much. And I have a twin brother, so I feel like I even had an easier way of it than most people. But players talk about it a lot, and Sarah Byrne has my favourite story because she was playing in boys' teams, as they pretty much were, for years. And when she went to a tournament when she was like 8 years old or 10 years old, something like that, quite young, and a male coach was like saying he wouldn't let her play on his team because they were doing like mixed teams, wouldn't let her play, don't want girls playing rugby, da da da. So she waited until he was on the tackle bag and then absolutely floored him. He went flying. And she loves telling that story. And she's not someone she's not vain at all. So I completely believe that's exactly what happened. And I've seen family members of hers tweet about that as well. So it's definitely happened. And I love that. So I think it is really hard. And there are so many times in life when you notice things and you say, oh God, I'm the only woman here. And it's sometimes tough. And, you know, I've had that as a journalist. I've gone to rugby matches and been mistaken for a caterer or told that the women's toilet's broken in the press room. So I have to go and find go in the men's toilets and just shout, I'm in here, please don't come in, or have to announce to people in the press box, I need the loo, so can no one go in the men's toilets for a bit, you know, or go into events and being the only woman there. And so I kind of have it in that sense. But for players to turn up week in, week out to rugby training sessions when they're surrounded by boys, a lot of them say that they faced kind of discrimination from the boys. The boys would be like taking the mick out of them as kids do, or using girl as an insult, girly as an insult.
Yeah.
To stick to it, right, and to get to the international level in that sport, I think it's remarkable. Because it'd be so easy to just say, you know what, I just don't want to do this.
Sod this, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it's, and I've never, and you've got to kind of be confident and assertive from, I don't know why I'm telling you this. Do you know what I mean? You are a woman who's moved through the world as a woman. So, you know, but it's this reflection of, you have to be confident and assertive from the age of 7 and stand your ground. And I suppose the point you made then about your experiences, you know, I mean, does that get easier? Do you still have to kind of have a situation now? You've got to think, right, I've got to fucking go in this press box now and kind of, you know, don't puff up, stand my ground, get in there sort of thing. Is it still like that, or am I overstating things?
Well, I'm lucky that there are so many amazing women that do work in sports journalism, and especially the women's game. You know, to name a few, Fee Thomas, Sarah Orchid, Sarah Mockford. There are just so many brilliant women's rugby journalists who mean, so when we go into a press box for women's rugby, it's nothing like that at all. It's kind of probably more women than men. But definitely when I cover the men's game, I always hate it. I hated during lockdown when we'd be on Zoom and I'd realise I was the only female face on the Zoom, and then I'd have to ask a question. And like, I always quite like that Eddie Jones would call me mate anyway. I always thought that was quite nice. He didn't discriminate, he didn't call me babe or something. And I've had no, you know, terrible experiences or anything like that. It's fine. And most male journalists are fantastic, very welcoming, warm people who've taken me under their wing a bit, especially when I was young and starting out, and introduced me to the right people and made sure I'm comfortable. And I'm part of the Rugby Union Writers Club, and they've also been quite helpful in that. So I've never been made to feel like an outsider. I think it's just that you do feel like an outsider, even if people are really welcoming. As I say, I was at Twickenham when I got mistaken for a caterer. And I've been in press boxes where they don't have a women's toilet. And it's that kind of thing, that it's not necessarily the people you work with. It's just the environment that you're in. And also sometimes like coaches, I've sometimes felt like coaches or players don't quite not want you there, but they don't talk to me as kind of friendly as others as they talk to the bloke. No, I've noticed that a lot. You know, I remember Wayne Pivak was quite bad at it. I'd ask a question and he'd give me like quite a muggy response, but he'd then talk to other people nice. And I was just like, why? And I just thought, oh, I'm the only woman here. If anything, don't you want to make yourself not look like a sexist? If you're going to be like muggy to anyone, pick one of the many white men here, not just the one girl. Like, pick on someone else. Like, yeah, sometimes. But no, in general, I've been very lucky, especially at the Times. A lot of the writers there from the get-go were really good and kind and made sure I was invited to things. If I wasn't on a guest list or something, made sure I was. So yeah, in general, very, very positive.
And it's I sometimes feel when I'm thinking about this stuff and you think about the questions you're going to ask and you look at the women's game and we talk about it on the pod, and you sometimes think, if all you ever do is focus on the narrative of what you have to overcome, which is not to minimise what you have to overcome, by the way, but then again, you don't start talking about what's actually happening or
what
stuff like that. But then you see on the BBC today, there's a massive survey out that people still don't really understand that women have hips and need different kit still, you know, like, so today there's basically a whole thing about sports equipment. And, you know, I mean, literally we can get AI to create an Oasis album, but we can't get people to understand that women have different shaped hips in designers. I don't know. It's mad. And I suppose that's the problem. What am I saying here? I suppose what I'm asking is, do you still get, is it, how easy it is not to get worn down by it, I guess, if this is what is happening still?
I think it's hard sometimes to focus on other things. And one thing that I'm quite big on is that women's rugby journalism can sometimes do itself a disservice by only focusing on the off-pitch issues.
Yes.
And we have incredible athletes here who are playing a really tactically smart game, et cetera, et cetera. And if we're just focusing on, you know, someone forgetting to put men's in front of a record, or if we're focusing just on the kit or who their girlfriend is, then we can actually lose sight of what's important, not just to the fans, but to the athletes themselves. Because athletes like to talk about the off-pitch issues, but they then want to talk about themselves and the game and the rugby that they're playing and the training they're putting into it. And I feel like we can lose sight of that sometimes. So it was quite important to me, like, especially in writing this book, but always really in all my writing, that I try and treat it with the same respect that we treat men's rugby. We mention the off-pitch issues and we do features about the off-pitch issues, but when we're talking about the games and we're talking about we need to actually have analysis in the women's game and discuss that and debate that and have these conversations that don't just treat them as if they're celebrities who have these issues to overcome and, you know, all those challenges that are so important to talk about but aren't relevant to what they actually are doing day to day. And Jill Burns, the former Red Rose, I spoke to her when I was writing this book, and she said to me that, and it's so true, and I didn't like the conversation, but she said to me, you know, I don't understand. She said, I was on Twitter earlier and I saw someone moaning about how they don't have women's rugby boots. And I just thought it's ridiculous. You know, when I think about what I had to put up with in my day, and you can get drawn into that comparison very quickly. Mm. And it almost becomes this toxic thing when you're constantly focusing on the off-pitch issues. It becomes, the debates become toxic and it completely takes away from the sport. So I do try and focus on the sport as much as I can. I like to think that's what I do. Is in the book, it was important for me to have like a chapter about the tactics, a chapter about the behind the scenes staff that help the team get to where they are, and like talk about the stuff that happens, talk about the problems. There's a whole chapter about concussion, maternity, body image, etc. But the focus is very much the rugby, which is what we all enjoy.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, as I said, the major things I really loved about the book, actually, because I think I said before we came on and started recording that the worry with all these, oh, is this one of those embedded with the camp type ones? And they can sometimes be not the most interesting thing in the world and a bit full of cliche and stuff like that. And then when I read it, I was, as I said, I was just genuinely, the amount you cram in to a relatively small book about history, the politics of it, the fact politics runs through all of it, everything you've just reeled off there, the tactics, the actual experience of losing that big tournament.
Yeah.
You know, the kind of the last generation of players coming across into this new generation, that whole, I'd forgotten all about that thing with the contracts in 2017.
Yeah.
And I vaguely remembered it, but of course, reading about it then, I was just like, that is unbelievable. I mean,
yeah.
Well, they all had to basically said, look, if you don't sign this, you can't train.
Yeah.
Which I know a few things about things. I don't know much about contract law, but I can't see how that level of coercion could be seen as an actual contract that could be agreed to. But that just shows you where it was at, doesn't it? And the things I learned I did not know, right? So the Rugby Football Union for Women was still separate to the RFU till 2010.
Yeah.
In some way or another. Stuff you just, if you can't believe it. If somebody said it, you go, oh, fuck off, that's not true. And of course it is, isn't it? It just shows you, in a way, it's amazing that it shows you how quickly things have actually come good in some ways, even with all the problems, isn't it?
But yeah.
Why did it take so bloody long to get there in some ways as well? It's all of that, isn't it?
But you're so right. We forget that it's fairly recent. It was only 10 years ago that the World Rugby even recognised the first two Women's Rugby World Cups in 91 and 94. And you're right about the contract chaos between in 2016, 2017, how players were, you know, considering strike action. This is England Women's Rugby players.
Yeah.
The culture was quite bad. You know, Gary Street talks about it in the book as well, about how it was when he left after the 2014 Women's Rugby World Cup, which they obviously England won. There's lots to remind you that it's fairly recently that the RFU started supporting England women. And I didn't want that to be forgotten because I feel like it could be brushed under the carpet. They went professional first. They're doing pretty much everything right, you know, or they're at least on the way to doing everything right. There's a lot you can criticise them for now even, but they're trying and they're doing a pretty good job of trying at that. And they're, compared to every other country, they're doing really well.
Yeah.
But that's quite recent. And it would be a complete disservice to the players to try and brush over that and say, oh, you know, it's great, they're brilliant, the RFU love women's rugby, blah, blah, blah. When you've got players like Marley Packer, captain of England, who says, oh, I remember when I was on a bus, a coach, and they wouldn't let me off the coach until I'd signed a contract to play for them. And I was a home serve plumber at the time and had to sign a sevens contract, even though I was playing 15s, just so I was contracted. And sort of that, like it really is very recent history. And I do think we will hear in the years to come stories about what the other countries are doing now with the contracts. I think we'll hear players give their versions of those stories soon. And it shouldn't surprise anyone.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? That's why I don't have a lot of time for when, if somebody for the RFU or somebody said something like, well, we invested heavily in you, why didn't you win the World Cup in 2021? It's like, I'll tell you what, mate.
Yeah.
Come back when you've invested for 150 years at a level that you did for the men's game and start asking a question about whether they've been successful enough. Because nobody really wants that discussion about the men's game, do they? 150 years of investment. Are you happy with how successful they've been? Discuss. Yeah. Well, we're not going to discuss that. We're talking about men's rugby. But the point, you see the point I'm making, which is the point you were making, really. But things, again, you don't realise, and this is real nuggets in the book, but Kim Shaler's sliding doors tackle in 2006, you know, stuff I didn't know anything about, which I won't give away too much, spoiler it in the book, but effectively a tackle that meant women's rugby survived, effectively, isn't it? You know.
Yeah, so Gary Street told me about that, and I had no idea about it, but essentially there was one tackle, and if England had missed the tackle, Canada would have won, and England would have lost their lottery funding for their women's rugby team. I didn't know that story, and I checked out the players.
Amazing story,
brilliant. And the sliding doors thing. I hope people get that reference. I just thought as you said that, I thought, gosh, anyone younger than me would probably be like,
I'm all about the 90s references, me. Was it the 90s or the 2000s Sliding Doors? I can't remember. No,
great film, though.
Brilliant. Well done. And how easy was it? How difficult was it to write, generally speaking, on top of everything else? Was it a labour of love? I suppose all books are in the end, aren't they? But
yeah. So I only had 3 months to write it.
Good Lord.
because they wanted it to turn it around so fast. So I had between March and June last year to write it. And it was really hard. I had a full-time job at the time and was working, you know, long hours with that. I was then having to write the book in my spare time. So I would, you know, use my weekends to go and travel and meet people. I'd be in camp in the weeks. I'd use all my annual leave really to be in the camp with the England women's rugby team. So it was really hard. I have to say, I think it's the hardest I've ever worked on anything. So it's 70,000 words, this book. And I interviewed every player, every coach, most of the former coaches, every backroom member of staff, and quite a few people who used to be involved in the squad too. And I mean, there's nothing I'd rather write about. So there was that. And a lot of it was stuff I already knew. So I was able to write quite a lot of it based on just knowledge and having been there at games and stuff, and going back to some of my old match reports and nicking a bit of that and saving some time. But
plagiarising yourself, we all do it.
Yeah. Which is allowed. You have to reference yourself, though. So I actually ended up taking some of it out because I couldn't face the indignity of having to reference myself. Yeah, so it was really, really hard. And it was so important to me to get it right because I was worried about what players would think when they read it. And I wanted, there are so few history books about women's rugby. Scrum Queens and World in Their Hands and Mudmore Mascara are fantastic. But this is about the England women's rugby team, and people were expecting it to have the history and be about the current squad, and that's really hard to do. And I also didn't want to shy away from the issues, and I wanted to go into lots of detail about the World Cup, and by also making it a good read, which is really, really difficult things to juggle. So it was incredibly difficult, but I'm happy with it. I'm pleased. I'm so pleased I did it, and hopefully there'll be another one. I'd love to write another book about maybe the 2025 Rugby World Cup. I think that could be really interesting. I'd like to see if the Red Roses can harness the Lioness effect. So I think that's on the cards. And I'd like to maybe even consider going around all the Six Nations teams and doing similar books, but they wouldn't let me in. That's the problem. But Ireland, they would never, ever let me anywhere near their camp. That's the issue.
The IRFU, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, why would they? They don't want anybody. They don't want anybody looking too closely at that, do they?
Well, exactly. So that's genuinely the problem. Like, at least the RFU can say, well, we're doing things right now. So yeah, you can go into camp and see how much we're doing. But yeah, I'd like to kind of consider a second book, but I think my family will kill me because they how sleep deprived and just overworked I was really close to burnout, to be completely honest. It was really tough, but it's done and I'm just able to enjoy it now.
Well, yeah, you got to hold it in your hand and come and talk to the likes of me about it. And I'm quite late on the interview rounds. You've done quite a few, haven't you? But it's, you know, well deserved, because it's really good, and you should be very, very proud of it for what that's worth.
Thank you.
Just to kind of close off then, a couple of you do say, to come back to the book and just to close off, you do say in the book at some point, I can't remember where, but I've got the words right, but you say something like, everything you are or everything I am is because of women's rugby.
Yeah.
You say something like that. You know, you don't know where that ends and you start or something. Yeah. I can't remember if that's the right word. I mean, do you ever contemplate what it would have been like if it hadn't been for that student with a straight arm tipping cider on her face in Swansea? Is it, you know, it's will it always be like this, do you think?
Yeah, it's a really good question and quite scary to think about, because I met my fiance through rugby, and I my whole career my best friends, it's all through rugby. You know, my two of my bridesmaids were because I met them, because I played rugby with them. And it is strange to think about what life would be like if I'd never picked up the rugby ball. I think I'd probably be writing about politics. I think I'd be doing something, probably women's rights or something.
You think your life on Twitter's bad now?
Yeah, imagine. Yeah, so I'd like to think that. Or I always kind of thought that in another life I might have been like a cookbook writer because I love baking.
So I remember you mentioned that when you were on the pod. You were used to, I think you said something about you stopped baking when you left Wales. I'm sure you said something like that. And I was thinking, what?
Yeah, it's a really rad story. But I found out about Dan Biggar leaving Wales to go to Northampton before the media did, because I was his wife that had a bacon account and I had a bacon account too. And she and I put two and two together because she said that she was having to move to Northampton for her husband's job. And I was like, what does your husband do? And she said, oh, he's a rugby player. Then I realised that her name was Bigger Bakes. And I was like, oh, my gosh. So, there's that. I've always thought maybe something like that. But no, I'm very grateful. My life would be so different without rugby. I absolutely adore it. And I hope that, you know, my kind of dream is to be kind of a full-time focus on women's rugby. I'm kind of doing that now. I've just got a new job as editor of Contested, which is a sports app focused on women's rugby. So I'm doing that now. But, you know, that to me is the dream job, just writing about women's rugby all the time. And I definitely don't know where I stop and women's rugby begins because it's such a huge part of my personality. And I'm very lucky that Nick, my fiance, was in the women's rugby world long before me, and you know, funded himself to go to the 2017 Rugby World Cup because he coached a lot of the Wales team. So it's things like that, like I would just wouldn't know where to start really. I'm so pleased I found it because it is the biggest passion in my life.
Well, how lovely. So and what's you're working for Contested, that's what's on your agenda now. That's your job. What's happening apart from planning a wedding? What's happening in the future? Or is that all you can think about now? Don't try and write a book while you're planning a wedding.
Absolutely, that's the thing. I am trying to plan, so we're getting married next year, which is obviously a big year for rugby because you've got the Lions and the Women's Rugby World Cup. So there's quite a lot to kind of, and the Six Nations. So I had to kind of work out what weekend we could get married in based on the rugby calendar, which was quite unique.
At least he'd understand.
Yeah, he did. He wouldn't want to get married when there's like a big game on. And we did consider, because he's Welsh and I'm English, we did consider getting married on the 15th of March next year, which is when Wales-England play in the Men's Six Nations. But we decided that it would just get too heated and it could be quite brutal. So we decided against it. So yeah, I'm definitely, the wedding is a big thing in my diary, as you'd imagine. But I'm definitely, I'm so keen to write a second book. So I'd love to do that next year. I'd love to do it. But I'm keeping busy. I'm doing a lot of my work with Contested is so much fun. I'm just writing about women's rugby. I've got columnists who are all women's rugby players. We've got Clee Maloney, interesting one, because she's obviously former Ireland player. Poppy Cleal, who is just one of the most fantastic rugby brains I've come across. She understands the game at such a great level. She's going to be a fantastic coach when she's when she retires, hopefully a long time from now. I've always thought she might be a referee, but I think she's too chopsy to be a referee. And then we have Sarah Byrne as our third columnist for the Women's Six Nations. I just get to chat to women's rugby players all day and write about women's rugby, and that's pretty much heaven for me. So I'm very happy. I'm loving my job. I'm loving being able to talk about women's rugby all the time because the Six Nations and the book. And yeah, the future's definitely another book, though.
Fantastic. Where can people find you, Jess, if they want to get in touch with you?
I'm on Twitter at underscore Jess Hayden. I'm on Instagram at Jess Hayden Rugby. I think I'm on TikTok under the same... Oh, no, on TikTok, I think I'm at underscore Jess Hayden, but I don't really use it. And my book is available from... am I allowed to say that? Am I allowed to give it?
Yeah, exactly. That was my next question. Where can people find the book? Why else are you here?
I just realised that I just realised that I might be selling it. So you can buy it at Waterstones, WH Smith, all the major bookshops. It's in store and online, foils, etc., or on Amazon. But you can also order it on bookshop.org, which allows you to direct the funds towards your local bookshop, which is quite a nice way to support a local bookshop. But I was actually very pleasantly surprised to find it in my very small local bookshop. They only bought one copy and I didn't tell them it was my book. And she said, oh, if we don't sell it, we'll just send it back to the publisher. And I was like, all right.
So, do you ever get over the excitement of seeing that? Oh, look, there's my book.
No, it's only happened to me twice and I've almost cried both times. So I went into Waterstones in Twickenham and they had like a nice stack of them by the door. Was tempted to go and put it in the window, but didn't want to get kicked out. And I saw it in my local bookshop. And it is just, I've got it here next to me. It's why I keep looking down. I just keep staring at it. If you're wondering why I keep looking down to my left, I know listeners can't see that. But yeah, so I do, it's so special. The first time it arrived, I tried to film a video of me like unboxing it because I was so excited. And I'm so not an influencer or a TikToker. I managed to get in my home address.
You doxed yourself online.
Yeah, you could have literally taken all my money because I had my home address, my debit card, and then my mop was in the background.
Nobody can't say it's not a glamorous life, Jess. This life you've chosen. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this. The book is great. I advise everybody to go and have a read of it. Genuinely really good stuff. And thanks for your time. Thanks for, you know, answering my multitude of questions. I'm sure people will find it very interesting. And we'll see you soon and see all you listeners again soon. And we had no pod this week. Apologies again for those of you. We'll be back on the normal run of things next week. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. Bye, Jess.
Bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.